Hey, folks, we're supposed to live off the soil, not become part of it. What's the solution? I had very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason could never teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the less likely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain its origin. The really amazing thing is that quantum physics shows that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and knowledge in ways biblical faith never does. Hi, folks. Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome back to the program. In 2005, maybe some of you saw it, I don't know, Hollywood produced War of the Worlds starring Tom Cruise. It was in a remake of an H.G. Wells novel about an invasion from outer space. The movie, though, that came out instead in 2005 didn't cause anywhere near the hoopla that the radio version caused in 1938. And the reason why, they're playing it over the radio, and people all over the country are listening to it, and they actually thought it was real. They thought that people, creatures from Mars, came and had invaded the state of New Jersey. It began. The program began like this. Let me read you from the transcript that was on the radio, aired over around the country. It began, "Ladies and gentlemen, here is the latest bulletin from Intercontinental Radio News, Toronto, Canada. Professor Morse of McMillan University reports observing a total of three explosions on the planet Mars between the hours of 7:45 p.m. and 9:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This confirms earlier report received from American observatories." Okay, so they're just listening to the radio. If they didn't catch that this was H.G. Wells' War of the World, they turn that on, they hear it. Three explosions on Mars? Okay, well, whatever. Anyway, what happens next? The broadcast continues, okay? "Now, near home comes a special bulletin from Trenton, New Jersey. It is reported that at 8:15 p.m., a huge flaming object, believed to be a meteorite, fell on a farm in the neighborhood of Grover's Mills, New Jersey, 25 miles from Trenton. The flash in the sky was visible within a radius of several hundred miles, and the noise of the impact was heard as far north as Elizabeth. We have dispatched a special mobile unit to the scene, and we'll have our commentator, Carl Phillips, give you a word picture of the scene as soon as we can reach him from Princeton." And I love this part. "In the meantime, we take you to Hotel Martinet in Brooklyn, where Bobby Millette and his orchestra are offering a program of dance music." Nothing changes in America. Commercials, commercials, commercials. Anyway, as the broadcast progressed, the correspondent comes to Grover's Mills farm. And instead of a meteorite, what did he see? He saw a giant cylinder that had landed in the field. Okay, that's weird enough. But then something started to crawl out of the cylinder. Again, people, if they hadn't heard what it was, and, you know, that this was War of the Worlds, they turn on the radio. This is what they're hearing. Anyway, what does the correspondent say? Here's what the correspondent says. He described it. He goes, "Good heavens, something's wriggling out of the shadows like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me. I can see the thing's body now. It's large, large as a bear, and it glistens like wet leather." Okay, come on. So he's describing this thing that's coming out of it. Then he goes on and he says, "I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful." And he continues, "The eyes are black and gleam like a serpent. The mouth is V-shaped with saliva dripping from its rimless lips that seem to quiver and pulsate. The monster, or whatever it is, can hardly move. It seems weighed down, possibly by gravity or something. And then it goes on describing what else. You know, the thing's rising up now, and the crowds fall back, and I can't find words to describe this. And he goes, I'll have to stop until I can take a new position. Hold on, if you please. I'll be back in a moment. We are bringing you an eyewitness account of what's happening on Wilmoth Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Now, remember, this is in the 1930s, folks. And as I said, if they hadn't heard before, this is what they're listening to. And the point was, not knowing this was a dramatization, panicked Americans fled into the streets or into air raid shelters. They thought that we were being invaded by monsters from Mars. The New York Times, and the next day in an article, described what happened. Listen to this. A wave of mass hysteria seized thousands of radio listeners between 8:15 and 9:30 o'clock last night, when a dramatization of H.G. Wells' fantasy, The War of the Worlds, led thousands to believe that an interplanetary conflict had started with invading Martians spreading death and destruction in New Jersey and in New York, okay? And it goes on, the article goes on, in Newark, a single block said more than 20 families rushed out of their houses with wet handkerchiefs and towels over their faces to flee from what they were afraid was a gas raid. Some began moving household furniture. Throughout New York, said families left their homes, some to flee to nearby parks. Thousands of persons called the police, newspapers and radio stations here and in other cities of the United States called in seeking advice on protective measure against the raids. Now, you know, from our perspective today, I mean, think about it. Invaders from outer space, invaders from, come on, from Mars of all things. You know, I mean, admittedly, it does sound kind of corny, okay? Yet science, but again, we're looking at it from our perspective today. We know a lot more. But you know, as corny as that might sound, do you know that some scientists today and in the past are using a similar argument to explain the origins of life on Earth? And that's because, think about it, if you leave out God, see, for some reason, science has got it in its head, you just got to leave out God, it's not scientific. If you a priori rule out God for the explanation, you got to come up with something else. And so you need something, and some haven't bought into this idea that chance alone could do it. So why not space aliens? I mean, what other options do you have? I mean, there's a common scientific model. There's one that's very popular now, which says that we came to exist by nothing but a group chancing of matter and energy alone. Matter and energy alone by chance came together and voila, here we is, okay? With that single argument, wrote zoologist Ernest Haeckel, the mystery of the universe is explained, the deity annulled, and a new era of infinite knowledge is ushered in. Well, not so fast, Ernest. Over the decades, and by the way, Ernest died in 1919, scientists have been finding such complexity within the universe, such incredible fine-tuned balances of forces essential to human life, that, folks, it's more likely for rain falling on this keyboard to type out the Iliad in Greek, in Greek and Latin and Finnish, than for chance alone to explain our existence. In fact, and the fact is, as much as they hate admitting it, more and more or scientists and more thinkers are saying, hey, you know, this is kind of reality. The chance thing just isn't quite working anymore as we used to think it did. Faced with these facts, some scientists have come up with another idea. Time magazine a while back came up with an idea that, quote, our universe might have been manufactured by a race of super intelligent extraterrestrial beings. Okay? This was Time Magazine. This is what some people are saying. Again, you rule out God. No, forget that stuff. That's myth. That's religion. You know, we can't have that. And chance doesn't work. So, well, what do we got? Well, let's see. All right, how about space aliens? Aliens, supernatural beings from another planet. In fact, what's very interesting, and I might have talked about this before, and I might even want to do another show on this. There's a philosopher at Oxford. His name is Nick Bostrom. And he wrote a paper. And I read the paper. And you know, it was quite well argued. He did quite a good argument. He argued, hey, folks, we're not real. We don't really exist. We are nothing but computer algorithms. That there's some super race out there in the universe of, you know, with their high-powered Macs, and we are just part of a computer program. I mean, kind of somewhat like the Matrix. And Bostrom argued this. He argued, and he gave his reasons, boom, 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 for it. And, you know, it was very interesting to me just for the fact that you could come up with some wacko theory and yet, at the same time, have some pretty convincing arguments for it. Of course, and I don't want to go down this track now, but Bostrom's argument, let's say, fine, a bunch of super aliens somewhere created us on their laptops or their desktops or their whatever, and we're here. That's okay, great, that's wonderful, fine. But then where do the aliens come from? Where did they get their computers? Where did they learn how to, you know, such advanced civilization that they could create all this on a computer. So, but anyway, the point is they're leaving out God and now they see chance doesn't work. So they got to come up with something else. And so they got this idea of space aliens or something creating us. In fact, I don't know, some of you have heard the name, imagine if you had high school biology, you've heard the name Francis Crick or of Crick and Watson fame. Okay. Crick and Watson. They won, you know, he won the Nobel Prize for the DNA spiel, the DNA double helix, explaining how genetics and all that works, okay? Now, he pushed a different theory. See, Crick said, forget it. There's no way in the world life could have formed by chance in the number of years we believe the Earth existed. It's way too complicated. So, again, and Crick, boy, he was a hardcore new atheist when Richard Dawkins was still in diapers practically. And anyway, Crick argued that aliens from another galaxy or from another planet came and sent rocket ships to the Earth to seed the life with, to seed Earth with life. And that began life that I assume he figured just evolved till we got here. And as I said, Crick wasn't some late-night radio talk show loon, you know, the kind of people you hear on the radio at 3 in the morning, which I tend to listen to every now and then. And it's funny, one writer in a prestigious magazine talking about this somewhat incredulously, he said, and thus the Nobel Prize winner embraced the theory that space aliens send rocket ships to seed the Earth. Now, I bring this up because it just shows you where people are forced to. And so we're forced to go, which in one sense, it makes you think maybe those Martians in H.G. Wells' story, maybe those Martians in the H.G. Wells story were the ones who originally seeded us, coming back trying to see how well things work out now that we've done that. Anyway, that's one of the theories that they have to explain life. Now, another one, and I believe I've talked about this on earlier shows, is somewhat well-received in the scientific community, certainly better than the space alien one, is what they call the many-universe hypothesis, okay? Which states simply that there are a very large, perhaps even an infinite number of other universes besides our own. Ours, the one in which we live in and that has the galaxies that we see and we scan with the Hubble telescope, this is just one of millions, maybe billions of them out there. And many of these other universes, the theory suggests, doesn't have, most of them don't have the incredible fine-tuning needed for life, okay? But, and here's the point, though. If you got billions and billions of universes out there, maybe even an infinite number, if you got an infinite number, then you got anything could happen, okay? So if you got an infinite number of universes out there, then yeah, there's probably a chance if you got enough of them, an infinite number, that sooner or later, one of them is going to have the incredible fine tuning, this incredible variables that are needed to sustain life. So the more universes you get out there, the greater the odds of them turning out to have one like ours. So that's the new theory. Now, they've never seen even one other universe. They're having a hard enough time understanding what's in our universe, much less billions of others, okay? And fine. I mean, I don't know. They've got some very smart people saying they've got, you know, theoretical evidence for these universes. Fine. Who am I to challenge on that? And but it does leave one simple question. You know, we have a hard enough time explaining where our one universe came from. How do you explain billions and millions or an infinite number of universes? May I humbly ask, where did they come from? Well, they got answers for that too. Don't kid yourself. Some say black holes created them. You know, we all heard of black holes in science fiction, these mysterious entities that are so dense. The matter so dense, you know, gravity is just mass bending space and time, and it's so dense that they pull everything into them. And even light can't escape. And you can read some great science fiction stuff about what happens when you get sucked past the event horizon into a black hole. You're in trouble, put it that way. Anyway, the idea is somehow, by tearing and rearranging the fabric of space-time, black holes continually create new universes, whose black holes create new universes, and on they go, and we have an infinite number of universes out there. So sooner or later, you're going to have one that creates has the parameters we need to have life that we have on Earth. Fine. Again, you know, who am I? Okay. Anyway, that's one theory. Another theory is called inflationary cosmology. And this seems a little more reasonable, but this is the idea basically that when the universe was first created, some small section of it expanded exponentially fast, and this just kept on like bubbles creating more bubbles and on and on and on and just growing and growing, and we got all these universes out there, okay? And again, all these universes, sooner or later, one of them's going to, quote, get it right, okay? Now, these are among numerous theories that are out there. And as different as they are, they all have one thing in common. And I believe what's behind this is almost like the metaphysical principle. That might not be the right way to describe it, but it's an underlying theme behind all of these theories, and it's one thing. It's an attempt to explain the incredible complexity and design that we see in the universe without recourse to what many would see the most obvious explanation, and that's a creator God, a designer. I mean, after all, come on, who needs God when you got space aliens and black holes, okay? But you tell me, folks. You tell me. I mean, I don't have all the answers. I don't know how a can opener works, much less get into all this stuff. But what makes better sense? I think of the verse in Acts 17:24. God who made the world and everything in it, or black holes which made the world and everything in it, or space aliens which made the world and everything in it. Now, as might be expected, some of these explanations for human life, aliens, black holes, people, you don't even have to be a biblical creationist to find some of these pretty unsatisfactory. You know, people say that the many universe hypothesis is just as speculative, it's much of a faith statement as is religion. Some scientists saying that. And then, you know, again, the infinite number of universes, I mean, if you're going to argue that, you can argue anything. Why not? If you can argue that, I'm going to argue that, well, if you wait long enough, you'll have a universe where everything is made of jelly beans. Or you're going to have a universe where women grow beards. Or you could have a universe where shrimp whistle Brahms. The rationality behind the many universe hypothesis is, I think, may I dare say it, a forfeiture of rational thought itself. Anyway, besides all these alternatives to God, it comes back to the question that I asked earlier, but it's probably worth repeating again. Okay, aliens created our universe. Okay, fine, that's fine. Great, you want to go that way? Go that way. It's better than some of the nonsense they got out there. But who or what created this aliens? Okay, so you don't really answer the question. And even if black holes created our universe, fine, a lot of smart people say that. But where did the first black hole and all the laws governing it come from? Black holes, from the little bit I've read, are pretty complicated things. There's a lot of mass, a lot of energy, and a lot of complicated physical laws that are part of that. Okay, where did that come from? Or cosmic inflation. Again, whatever you had to create that inflation, where did it come from? Where did the laws come from? Now, there's this argument. I love this argument. This argument says that we as humans cannot exist in a universe incapable of the kind of complexity and fine-tuned needing to produce us. Therefore, it's no big deal that we are here. The universe had to create us in order for us to be here and marvel at the mind-boggling balance of factors that make life possible. Okay? That's the argument. Okay? And I don't know, it seems a little circular. I once heard somebody describe it like this. Imagine a prisoner. He's in a firing squad. They got him lined up 20 feet from him, 10 feet from him. 10 people got guns. They go 3, 2, 1, boom, 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 boom. They all shoot him. And guess what? They all happen to miss. And, you know, all 30, whatever, they all fire, they miss. And he walks away free saying, of course they had to miss. Other words, I wouldn't be here to talk about it if they didn't. Nothing extraordinary here. And then, you know, this goes back. This is nothing new. In the 1800s, the philosopher David Hume, in the 18th century, he argued that, you know, he admitted there's incredible complexity in nature. He admitted, he even said something to the effect of that there's intricacy in design to a degree beyond what human senses and facilities can trace or explain. And again, this is a guy that died in 1776. So back then he saw it. But his argument is that he says that there might be something in matter itself, something in the created matter itself that enables it to be so exquisitely designed. Well, come on, that's ludicrous. That doesn't answer anything. It's easier to imagine paper and ink from something inherent in themselves creating the manuscript for Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment than to imagine carbon, water, and proteins organizing themselves into even something in the carbon, in the water, in the protein, organizing themselves into a single cell, much less into what ultimately led to Einstein's brain. Meanwhile, here's another question, too. How does this matter? How does inanimate matter? Protons, electrons, atoms, even chemicals, emerge into something greater than their constituent parts, like human life and human consciousness. It's more likely that a 100-pound woman in labor could give birth to a 150-pound baby than inanimate matter in and of itself, regardless of how much time given it, could ever form the life that we see here on Earth. You know, it's almost like this. There's a principle here. Think about this principle. Only something greater than itself could create something. In other words, only something greater than a creation can make a creation. Have you ever heard of an artist who, we've all heard of artists creating a self-portrait, but have you ever heard of a self-portrait creating an artist? What then about the universe and everything in the universe? Think about this. I don't know. It just seems simply logical to me. Only something greater than the universe could have created the universe. You see what I'm saying? I mean, again, how does a painting create the painter? It doesn't happen. You know, the painter creates the painting. How does could the universe be created unless it was created by something greater than the universe? And what possibly could that be but an eternal, all-powerful God, the God depicted in the Holy Scriptures, okay? But, you know, that leads to another question, though. Okay, fine. God created us. But, you know, the world's a pretty wretched place. I mean, let's just face it. We live, we suffer, we die. This God just creates us and puts us here. Well, gee, maybe thanks. But, you know, you might argue, thanks, but no thanks. Okay? I mean, go to a graveyard, eat a picnic lunch in the shadow of a tombstone. If what's in the ground below the picnic basket is your eternal destiny, then how could it not all be a farce? And I said, God created us out of the ground, folks. He never intended us to be put back there. We're just so used to it. We're supposed to live off the soil. We're not supposed to become part of it. That's why, according to Scripture, our God is not just the creator. He's also the redeemer, because he's going to redeem us. Because without redemption, nature itself, the world itself, works against us. The ground is constantly pulling us into it. We need, therefore, something beyond nature, something transcending nature, something greater than nature itself. And that's our God, our Redeemer God, whom Christians worship as Jesus Christ. I love these words from the poet T.S. Eliot. In my beginning is my end. Our beginnings, whether we acknowledge it or not, are in Jesus Christ. And our end, if we choose it, can be in Jesus Christ as well.